Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. I also am the pastor of the Lutheran Mission in Raynham, Kent. We meet the first Sunday of each month at 3 o'clock, and I serve as vacancy pastor for St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride. We meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. So again, if you live in those areas, please come and pay us a visit. Otherwise, check our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the nearest congregation to where you are, and I know you'll receive a warm welcome. Again, we thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio. Without your prayers and your gifts, we wouldn't be able to continue this ministry of bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ to our friends all over the world. We rejoice to have one of those friends with us again today, Dr. Robert Kolb. He is Emeritus Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. He is the author of many, many books. And as we're coming up to the 500th anniversary of Luther's burning of the papal bull, we wanted to talk to him a little bit about that today. So, Dr. Kolb, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, John.
Now, we hear this term, papal bull. What does that mean, Bob? And I'm sure Luther wasn't the first one to have received one of these. So could you give us maybe a little history about their development and what they were used for?
Yes, the Latin word bulla is simply a word for an official pronouncement, an official document, and the papacy issued many of them, you're right on that. Many of them were positive measures for various customs. There was also in the Middle Ages and in the city of Rome an active business of forging papal bulls. The story goes that a group of Norwegians came to Rome after the decline, or after the winters became longer and the summers shorter, in the 14th century, still you could grow wine in along the Norwegian coast as far north as Trondheim, I understand. But when that possibility vanished because of climate change, the Norwegians came to Rome, and the papacy would not grant them a bull to substitute beer for wine in the Lord's Supper, but they found a forger who was willing to make such a papal bull. Well, it was not only for positive measures that these documents were issued by the papal court, the bureaucracy around the pope, but they were also issued as documents of condemnation, of conveying excommunication. And the papal bull that we're talking about in connection with Luther was just such a bull. This one actually announced that if he did not recant in 60 days, I believe it was, then he would be excommunicated. And another document came later in early January of 1521, which then actually executed the excommunication. So the bull that Luther burned in December of 1520 was this announcement that he was about to be excommunicated. And the students at Wittenberg, perhaps egged on by probably not Luther, but one of the other professors, demonstrated their protest against the condemnation of Luther, because he was an extremely popular professor. They demonstrated that with burning the papal bull and some of the old books of medieval theology that had become textbooks for them.
Now, as I understand it, again, this is stuff that we in the 21st century, I think, find hard to understand, that not only the papacy could issue such a thing as a papal bull, but this was also recognized by the civil authorities, and also there was a big role played by universities. Is that true?
Yes. Life was not divided into its various parts, and the distinctions between various realms of life weren't so accented as they are for us today. But the universities were largely staffed by clergy, not completely, but almost fully staffed by clergy in terms of their instructional force. And the government and the papacy, the secular government of the papacy throughout Western Europe worked usually very closely, even though there were some rivalries there and some very tense moments. But there was a close cooperation because both were authorities, and the preservation of authority held society together. Society was very fragile. There was violence of various kinds nipping at the edge of the lives of many people. And so to have authority to know what was right and what was wrong was very important. I suppose many of us today have so much money that we can buy ourselves out of jams. In the 16th century, a much larger percentage of the population wanted to know right from wrong, yes from no, and to have solid authorities.
So as we look then at the events that lead up to this issuing of the bull in 1520, my guess is the Pope would never have heard of Luther before that time, and probably took a little while to hear of him even after the posting of the 95 Theses. Is that right?
That's correct. The path to reform, I think, begins in Luther's own mind, probably at the beginning of the 15 teens, when he was still shaping his theology. It's not as though he abandoned positions he had defended. It was more that he was taking what he had gotten from his professors and trying to wrestle through it. And as all students of theology, trying to construct his own understanding of what the Bible is saying. And slowly but surely, he came to the conviction, first of all, with the help of St. Augustine, the fourth and fifth century theologian who profoundly influenced the medieval church. With Augustine's help, Luther saw that we are completely dependent on the grace of God. The whole of the life of the creature is determined by the Creator. And that was in about 1516, we think. And then slowly but surely, he began getting new definitions of many of the key biblical terms as they had been interpreted in the so-called scholastic theology, in the medieval theology that he had learned at the university, and in his cloister, in his Augustinian cloister. So he was revising his understanding of key biblical terms, and in 1517, he had one of his students defend theses like the 95 Theses, but not for general discussion. These theses were so that this student, Franz Günther, could be promoted to the next degree that he was seeking. And there he challenged the dependence on Aristotle. The university theology, the so-called scholastic theology of the Middle Ages, worked very intensely within a framework set by the pagan philosopher Aristotle. Luther's big problem with Aristotle was that he did not have a creator God. And so his understanding of reality was based on what you could see and what you could sense in what was called the eternal law of God. And so human beings were supposed to be conforming themselves, using their reason, conforming themselves to that eternal law. And there was no creator, personal creator. And so Luther found Aristotle an inadequate framework, a false framework, a deceptive framework. So he speaks out against that. But then in 1517, later, just a month later after those theses on scholastic theology and Aristotle, Luther has a pastoral problem, and that's the problem of indulgences. And so his 95 theses were just to be an innocent academic exploration. Hey, guys, let's talk this over. But it exploded into controversy.
And that controversy then spreads. The ripples go throughout Europe. And how did the Pope hear about this? Was it from Albrecht, the Archbishop of Mainz, or did he hear about that through other channels?
Probably his faithful servant in Germany, who was the primate of the church in the German-speaking lands, Albrecht of Mainz, is certainly one of the people who sent him the theses. We don't know if there were others that did, but that's also possible. Usually something like this, a set of 95 short sentences for debate, would not have attracted all that much attention. Let the academicians do what they will. But four printers outside of Wittenberg saw the possibility of some sales. The sales weren't all that great, but they spread the word. And so it's entirely possible that one of these printings of the Latin theses, they were written in Latin for university academic debate, got to Rome apart from Albrecht of Mainz. Then Luther saw that the printing press had more possibilities than he had earlier recognized. And so within a few months, in very early 1518, he published a German treatise on indulgence and grace. And this German treatise spread like wildfire. It went through a number of editions very quickly. And so churchmen and some secular authorities probably all over the German-speaking lands were complaining to papal officials who were visiting in Germany about this Martin Luther guy.
The complaints reached high places pretty quickly, because in June of 1518, the Pope put together a commission or sought that to have these 95 theses looked at by our friend Pretorius, and he came up with a thing called the dialogue to refute them. So was this the beginning then of the roots of the bull and the condemnation?
Yeah, the issue of indulgences should not have caused a fuss at all. There was not a clear doctrine governing these grants of release from the temporal punishment in purgatory. Sometimes I think Protestants don't always understand what an indulgence is and was. It was popularly understood as forgiveness of sins, but in the theology of the church, an indulgence was not the forgiveness of your sin that you received from the priest in confession. But the indulgence was the release from the temporal punishment that you have to endure either in this life or in purgatory because of what sin brings with it. Well, I think probably on the popular level, people were telling Luther, who as an Augustinian brother was hearing confessions in churches in the Wittenberg area, where they were telling him, I don't need to go to confession. My sins have purchased forgiveness with this indulgence. But the theology and the practice of indulgences was not firmly set forth. And actually, indulgence practice in the 15th century, in the years leading up to Luther's birth, had changed, actually. So that shouldn't have caused a fuss. But what caused controversy was that in these 95 theses, Luther challenged the authority of the Pope. And that question of authority is always, I think, the burning issue for people in their daily lives. Where do I find the truth?
And that issue continued to be a burning one as Luther had run-ins with folks like Caetan and Eck. Can you help us understand how those meetings helped foster again this desire to excommunicate Luther?
Yeah, I think by mentioning both the Italian cardinal, Thomas de Vio, Cardinal Cajetan, and by mentioning Johann Eck, who was a professor in the South German University of Ingolstadt, you've hit on an important part of the whole Luther story. There was immediate reaction from Rome, from the papal court. And years ago on our campus here in St. Louis, I heard the English Reformation scholar E. Gordon Rupp just quip the line in discussion, Luther has never gotten credit for the books he did not write. And what Professor Rupp meant with that is that the Italian court's rebuttals, there were several theologians that felt compelled to say, to defend papal authority, but they attacked Luther personally with a viciousness that Luther's pretty sharp rejoinders never really reached. They had refined the art of insult to a very high or low, we might say, level. So there was that factor. But then there was also the German colleagues. John Eck had approved of some of Luther's earlier writings. There were only a couple of them, but it looked as though Eck and Luther could well become friends and be pursuing some of the same goals. But Eck was in some trouble for some of the positions he held with the official church. And so he decided that attacking Luther was the way to save his reputation. And he led the campaign. And even when at the papal court, then in the course of 1518, 1519, things seemed to, the flame was turned down, Eck kept stirring it up, and he went to Rome and pursued the matter of the excommunication of Luther.
And you mentioned about the flames being sort of turned down a little bit. Was that due to Cajetan, who seemed to have a little bit more of a mediating, let's take these one by one kind of approach to X, let's all throw them into one basket? Is that correct?
I think that could be. We don't have documents from him that, like personal letters and all, that would really tell us the whole story about Cajetan's inner thinking. But it's possible there that some of the papal court said, this too will pass. And Leo X is supposed to have said, well, why should I as Pope be interested in some monk's quarrel in Germany? There were always monk's quarrels in Germany and every place else, I suppose. And Leo loved to go on the hunt, and he was a patron of the arts, and he had other interests, and the theological squabbles in Germany, initially at least, weren't of much concern. But both John Eck and many of the people at the papal court convinced him that Luther posed a real threat, and of course they were right.
And then in 1519, you have the Leipzig debate. What part did that play, or did it play any part in, again, flaming the fan and flaming the fires?
Well, I think definitely you have Eck seeking out a debate with Luther. Nobody wanted to permit such a thing, but Duke George of Saxony, there were two sections to Saxony, and Luther's prince was Elector Frederick the Wise, and his cousin George was the duke in that section of Saxony around Leipzig. And so George was a very pious man. He had actually studied theology at the university as a young man, which was very unusual for a prince. And so he said, every opinion deserves to be represented. Now, he was shocked by some of the things that Eck got Luther to say about papal authority in the Leipzig debate. But you're really, you've really hit on an important point there, that that was a public confrontation between Luther, who had been posing questions, and John Eck, who was out to make those questions into heresy. And as a result of the debate, in the debate, but especially as Luther drew conclusions from the debate, he becomes much bolder in questioning whether there's any biblical basis for papal authority. And so the Leipzig debate really sped things on their way and intensified Eck's efforts to gain his excommunication.
Did the university responses to that help? I mean, you've got Cologne and you've got Louvain toward the end of 1519 as well, piling on Luther and saying, you know, this guy is a heretic. And again, did that play a big part, or is that just sort of peripheral?
I don't think it's peripheral, really. The universities, the theological faculties at the universities, had a strong voice in public discourse, much stronger than theological faculties do today, I think. The intellectuals, at least, listened to the so-called experts on the university faculties. And so I think that did play a role. It also, however, was an important factor that the universities didn't immediately respond, but they took their sweet time about it, as you say, a number of months before judgments came. And in that time, Luther published a number of short devotional treatises, sermons on the sacraments and the like. And that spread the word and gained him many, many more followers. I mean, his fan club was growing rapidly.
So with all of these things happening, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind, the bull is issued by the Pope, but he has university backing for this. He seems to have the backing of the politicians, the emperor. But who actually is the deciding factor? Is it the Pope himself, or could he point to somebody else and say this? Or who had the authority, I suppose? Where did the buck stop with the issuing of bulls and bans?
The buck really stopped officially with the Pope. The Pope was heavily dependent, as all rulers and monarchs are, was dependent on his bureaucracy, his court. And so the mechanics of preparing the excommunication and delivering it depended to a certain extent, lower level bureaucrats, but they were working under the direction of the leading advisors of Pope Leo X. And in a sense, as I think is probably true of most leaders, they're pretty much dependent on their advisors. If they have good advisors and get good advice, they make wise decisions. Sometimes they'll act independently of their advisors. It's not as though you can identify one person who is totally responsible. But in the end, the official responsibility lay with the Pope. As I say, the Pope would depend upon his own theologians, who were supposed to be experts on these questions, and then in a secondary way would depend on university opinions. And so it's a rather complex decision-making process. But finally, it happens because at the papal court, the mechanics were there to excommunicate.
Were there some calling for councils? I know Luther said, let a council decide. Were there others, perhaps even within the papal court, who were advocating, let a council decide?
There were such voices, although they were substantially diminished. That too is a very complex story. But back in the 14th century, there was a fight between the French king, Philip the Fair, and Pope Boniface the Eighth. And as a result of the French king's trying to govern his church somewhat independently from the papacy, at the beginning of the 14th century, the papacy went into what is sometimes called its Avignon captivity. The French king moved the residence of the pope from Rome to a papal territory surrounded by French territory in what is today southern France. And from Avignon, then the church was ruled for a good 60, 70 years. And then one of the popes went, when he was elected in Avignon, went back to Rome. Well, the French king at that time then did not want to allow that. And so he established his own papacy in Avignon, and Western Europe was divided. German-speaking lands were divided. Some territories pledged allegiance to Avignon and some to Rome. And as a solution to this really scandal in Christendom, at the end of the 14th and early 15th century, there developed a movement that said that popes are authorities in the church, but a church council has equal authority. And the whole conciliar movement then brought the schism to an end with the Council of Constance, where Jan Hus, the Bohemian heretic, was burned at the stake. But then, so the conciliar movement seemed to have made its case, but the 15th century is a series of battles between the conciliarists and the papalists, and the papalists finally won. So that while Luther could use that as a kind of propaganda tool, there was not sufficient support any longer in the Western Church for giving a council the kind of authority that Luther wanted it to exercise.
Well, speaking of authorities, Bob, for us, unfortunately, the clock seems to be the authority at the moment, and we're running out of time. But I'd like to invite you and our listeners back next week as we carry on this conversation as we approach the 500th anniversary of the burning of the bull by Luther and the students there in Wittenberg. So if you'd come back, we'd love to have you.
I'd be delighted. Thank you, John. It's always a fun experience to be in conversation with you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.